Well, we have been working our way through the book of Isaiah, and we have noted the strong emphasis in Isaiah on proper trust. And we have observed that God's people have a tendency and have had a tendency in the past to trust other nations for help instead of trusting Him, particularly when there were other nations out there scaring you, breathing down your neck, and you start looking for someone to turn to of a comparable nature instead of someone who is really over all. And you would think, with the rich history that the nation Israel had of seeing example after example of God coming through in incredibly miraculous and powerful ways, that they wouldn't hesitate in a minute to trust Him. But they were just like us. We tend to look around and we're just like Peter when he saw the wind and the waves and started to sink instead of looking to the Lord. They had a similar problem. Their trust had to be renewed for each generation, just like ours does as well. And we know that it just doesn't take long for people to lose that focus on the one that they really need to look to. Well, also we have observed and identified several nations that Israel and Judah were trusting instead of Yahweh. And we had noted back in chapter 7 that Israel had aligned itself, the northern kingdom aligned itself with Aram or Syria, and they were then going to give Judah some trouble. Judah was looking, at least initially, to Assyria, thinking, well, that's a pretty big country. They ought to be able to come to some help. Turns out they were breathing down their neck as well in due time, so that didn't go so well. And then Judah was also looking to Egypt for some help as an alternative. Somebody's got to be there that can help us. In the meanwhile, the prophets were coming along and saying, hey, hello, people, God is up there. That's where you need to be looking instead of all these other nations. And that's what Isaiah was trying to do this time as well. And last week we noted something about Cush, because the Cush was part of the equation. And when we saw in the text, it said Ethiopia. But then, and we know that that was there because of a statement from Josephus that indicated that Cush that was referenced at this time was identified with Ethiopia. But what we're trying to note is we need to look at Cush as a people group and not identify Cush with modern-day Ethiopia, because there's not a one-to-one correspondence there. There may be some overlap, but that's not exactly the case. Well, we saw last time that Cush was really part of Egypt and Sudan, and maybe as far as Ethiopia, modern-day Ethiopia, that is. And so it was really the Nubian people, the people group that would be associated with the Nubians today. And so there was a 100-year period of time that we had observed that the Nubian people exerted power over Egypt. So they were actually driving Egypt for a time, and it coincided with this period of time. And so that gave the people of Cush some superpower status at the time, but that doesn't and didn't absolve Egypt of its ultimate responsibility, because it still was a power in the process and had a long history of interaction with Israel and Judah. And so Egypt was still associated as being a mighty superpower, and that's why Judah was thinking about looking to Egypt for help. And when you think about the history of Israel and Judah with Egypt, how many times didn't the people of Israel and Judah look to Egypt for help? And they'd spent 430 years there in the incubator of becoming a nation. So All of this is to say that Egypt had a unique place in God's dealings. And we will see some evidence of that here. And there's something that we can learn from this. So that's what we want to keep in our minds as we move into looking at the text. And we'll be looking at chapters 19 and 20 and to try to get a little bit of an overview picture of what's going on. So what we see here in the first section, verses 1 through 15 of chapter 19, is there's a common pattern of a nation under judgment. When God says this nation is under judgment through Isaiah, as he does here, you see there are certain things that sort of fit with other nations that are under judgment. So there's some parallels that we can see. So we start with the text here, verses 1 through 4. It says, "The burden against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt." So there's an indication of something right there. It's going to be quick whenever it happens. "The idols of Egypt will totter at his presence, and the heart of Egypt will melt in its midst." So there's a response that's going to be taking place. Verse 2, "I will set Egyptians against Egyptians. Everyone will fight against his brother, and everyone against his neighbor, city against city, kingdom against kingdom. The spirit of Egypt will fail in its midst. I will destroy their council, and they will consult the idols and charmers, the mediums and the sorcerers, and the Egyptians I will give into the hand of a cruel master, and a fierce king will rule over them, says the Lord God of hosts." So that's in kind of an initial statement, letting you know that things are not going to go real well. Oh, and I forgot that I had to push the button to get you to see the second part of the verse there. Then there would be an extensive socio-political upheaval that's going on, and that's what's indicated here. First, the anticipated judgment was coming soon, referenced with the swift statement there. The Lord was going to be visiting Egypt, and when he did, her idols would prove impotent, and the people would respond in fear. And it's not unlike what had occurred at the time of the Exodus, and this is sort of a repeat of that, that Yahweh's going to come on the scene and put things in the place where they need to be. And that's kind of the imagery that's communicated here. The anticipated judgment would also include social chaos. There's some things to note. Egyptian society had generally a lack of unity throughout its history. There was frequent conflict between the upper and the lower portions of the country as far as geographical factions. And there were times during the various kingdom periods where the pharaoh was worshipped as God, and then there were times when there were long periods when the 42 city-states ruled themselves, and the people worshipped innumerable gods. So you had these different times of when Pharaoh was sort of strong, then they would focus on Pharaoh as their god king. And when Pharaoh was weak, then there was little social unity, and they would sort of do their own thing. And it's not uncommon with a lot of countries of the world where that kind of thing goes on. If you have a really strong leader, things kind of move in a certain direction, whether they like it or not. And then when they don't have a strong ruler, then things kind of become more localized and more distinct, and more dissidence between the groups. Also, this anticipated judgment would include political oppression. There would be a nation that would come that would cause problems and would be the ruler. And this nation, Egypt, would seek help from every other source that they would normally try to go to, looking to their idols, to the spirit world, and they would be ineffective because they're not real, and it would be a distraction from where they really need to go. And when this superior nation is going to come upon them, then that's going to be a problem for them. And so they're needing some help, and therefore they're trembling in fear because of what's coming upon them. Now, there seems to be a near fulfillment that takes place, and some have speculated that maybe it was when the Cushites had control over Egypt, whether it was Pianchi in 715 B.C. or Psammeticus in 670 B.C., or whether it was one of the Assyrian kings who came along, whether it would be Sennacherib II, or rather Sargon II, or Sennacherib, or Esarhaddon in 671, or Ashurbanipal in 668, because there were these various times when Egypt was being troubled by Assyria. And most conservatives would date it as the 671 under Esarhaddon, which was probably the occasion where this most immediate and near future occasion took place, which was then predicted by Isaiah at this point. And so when a people is under pressure, they become easy targets for other people, and therefore that was part of their problem. Then moving on, verses 5 through 7, the waters will fail from the sea, and the river will be wasted and dried up. The rivers will turn foul. The brooks of defense will be emptied and dried up. The reeds and rushes will wither. The papyrus reeds by the river, by the mouth of the river, and everything sown by the river will wither, be driven away, and be no more. Now, we don't have to think real hard and wonder, what river are they talking about? It's the Nile River. I mean, that was the essence of Egypt. That's what made Egypt even be able to function at all. Then continuing on, verses 8 through 10, the implications of this, the fishermen also will mourn. All those will lament who cast hooks into the river, and they will languish who spread nets on the waters. Moreover, those who work in fine flax and those who weave fine fabric will be ashamed, and its foundations will be broken. All who make wages will be troubled of soul. Well, what is that telling us? Well, there would be climatically caused economic disaster. If something happens to the river and the river pretty much runs everything in Egypt, then that's going to be a problem. And this may be looking toward a more far future occasion, perhaps associated with the tribulation period. Whether there was another more specific time, we don't have a direct record of that. The major source of economic prosperity would be disrupted. The Nile was the life-giving sustenance. Its food was able to be produced because there was water that was able to be used for irrigation. They would have intricate ways of getting water out of the Nile with various mechanisms to get it then distributed in the area. And it would be much like what you see if you go up on the crest and you look down in the valley here and you see, oh, the river's right there because it's this green belt that runs through it. And it's all green around the river. And why do people live in the Rio Grande Valley? Because there's water there. It's a very obvious picture. But you mess with the water and then all of a sudden you've got a problem. And so their economic prosperity depended on that. The personal emotional impact of this would be devastating. If you take away the major source of the economy, which is basically run by having access to that water, now you've got a problem. And so that was the concern. Hence, there would be the troubling of the soul of those people who would be there, and this would have a personal impact on the people as well. And we can relate to the idea of when you lose your economic stability, what happens? Isn't that a major concern that people have in our society today? I mean, if I don't have my economic stability to function, well, then what? I might have to trust the Lord or something. Isn't that what the text said? But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. In the context in Matthew 6:33, that's all he's talking about, providing for the basic needs. So Judah then is being reminded here not to trust in a nation that's under judgment that cannot sustain its own economy and political state. It's going to be having its own problems. So why are you wanting to trust them? And we could ask a similar question. Why, as a nation, do we seek help from other nations? Like, why do we look to China? Why are they bankrolling our country? Because we put ourselves in difficult straits and we don't know where else to turn? Because we don't follow practical principles that would keep us out of trouble? Well, that's a whole other issue. But you see, there's a parallel that we can relate to. Then chapter 19, verses 11 and 12. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools. That's one of the cities there. Pharaoh's wise counselors give foolish counsel. How do you say to Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of the ancients? Where are they? Where are your wise men? Let them tell you now, and let them know what the Lord of hosts has purposed against Egypt. You think you've got it all figured out, you wise people, but the Lord has things set in motion, in place according to his purpose. Then continuing on, verses 13 through 15, the princes of Zoan have become fools. The princes of Noph are deceived. They have also deluded Egypt, those who are the mainstay of its tribes. The Lord has mingled a perverse spirit in their midst, and they have caused Egypt to err in all her work, as a drunken man staggers in his vomit. Neither will there be any work for Egypt, which the head or tail, palm branch or bulrush may do. So it's basically saying your seeking help from your wise people, but they are fools, and that's going to end up with continued economic and other problems. Oh, and I didn't push that soon enough. There would also be intellectually deficient responses to problems. The supposed wise men of Egypt are no match for Yahweh. And again, putting things in perspectives, this nation's wise ones were woefully inadequate to the need. I mean, the wise men of Egypt were well known. They were noteworthy as being wise people, and they were proud of it as a nation, but yet they were fools when it came to dealing with the real important critical things that were needing to be dealt with at this time, because again, they were trusting in men, not trusting in God, and the result was that they were deluding the people. Now, all you have to do is think for a moment about the wise men of our day, the wise men of our nation. How wise are they? If you start with some wrong presuppositions, you end up in the wrong place and provide not good answers. And how many times have we observed policies, procedures, locally, statewide, nationally, where we say, what are you people thinking? Really, I mean, I just had read something about San Francisco dealing with their problem. Well, they have problem after problem, but one of their more recently recognized problems has to do with all of the vagrants and homeless people that are all over the place making a horrible mess, and so they've had to put together a poop patrol to go clean up the mess of the city because it's so nasty that even the mayor was appalled. And so they now have in place people, I think five people, that are making, with benefits and all of that, $185,000 a year to clean up the mess. So what does that tell you? The wise are fools. There are other ways to deal with some of these problems, and because of some of their presuppositions and their policies, they end up with bigger problems. So, just a reminder to realize how easily people get heading in the wrong direction when they don't start at the right place, the right presupposition. There is a God who has put things into place, who has created the world and has provided all that he has in many different areas without going into all the details. And if you don't start there, you're going to end up with some really foolish kinds of responses. Well, and then we observe the foolishness of a nation's leaders always negatively impacts its people economically and socially. We have observed that historically throughout the ages. We have observed it personally in our own time, whether nationally, statewide, or even locally. The same kind of scenario takes place. So we have observed this. The parallels are a little too unsettling in many ways. And our wise ones are anything but wise. And our leaders are often leading us to destruction. And so we need to be reminded that where ought we to look? Where should we be looking for our hope? To our government? To our leaders? Well, we have a responsibility to do our part, but we certainly can't be trusting them. We need to trust the Lord and His truth. The unexpected grace extended to a judged nation, as we look at verses 16 through 25, starting with verses 16 through 18. In that day, and so here we see a section where in that day is referenced several times, and it's telling you now we're looking more toward a more distant future kind of occasion here. In that day, Egypt will be like women. And usually there's some element of a nearer application, but it's looking more toward a more distant future. In that day, Egypt will be like women and will be afraid and fear because of the waving of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which he waves over it. So there's a recognition God is moving something, therefore there is a little bit of fear, because they're, on the one hand, denying God, but then realizing, wow, he is doing something. Verse 17, the land of Judah will be a terror to Egypt. Everyone who makes mention of it will be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts, which he has determined against it. In that day, five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan and swear by the Lord of hosts. One will be called the city of destruction. Now, what do we observe here? In a future time, Judah will experience an elevated position. Well, at this time, Judah is fearful. Judah is looking to Egypt as a potential place to go for help. And so Isaiah is saying, there's going to come a time, Judah, when you are going to be on the top of the pile here, and Egypt is going to be looking to you. So why are you going to be seeking help from them now? Why don't you just trust the Lord? So we observe the Lord will exercise his hand of control over Egypt. And there will be ways in which this will be recognized. And the result will be that Egypt will have an element of fear, realizing that God is actually in control. Egypt is not. And that is going to be a problem. In the past, Egypt has been that superpower and has acted as if it could do whatever it wanted. And when Pharaoh, at the time of the Exodus, was asked to give way to God's people to go worship in the desert, Pharaoh emphatically indicated, "Over my dead body," and eventually that took place. And so it wasn't exactly open to what God had to say, but this would be a turning of the tables. Now, the Lord will make Judah an object of fear to Egypt. And so the Lord would be exalting Judah over Egypt, and it would require, obviously, some divine instigation and control to bring that to pass, but the result would be an element of fear. Perhaps maybe Egypt would be thinking, "Oh, there's going to be retribution for the way that we have treated you over the years," kind of like Joseph's brothers thought after their father died, and that now Joseph is going to come down on them. Maybe they were thinking that, but it may have also just been that they are seeing God at work in Judah and having a sense that God is at work caught their attention in those people. But it does bring us to the question of, well, do people around us see God at work in the church today? Have you thought about that? Do people see God at work in the church today? Now, try not to think about the Catholic Church for a minute. What has happened there recently to hit the news? There is not much indication that God is at work, but that sin is at work. That's a little disconcerting. How does that reflect upon God's church? Not particularly positively. We may need to think about what are the implications? How do we deal with that? How much of a deterrent is this going to be? How much of a setback is this going to be when already people of faith are on the bottom of the pile as far as much of the mindset of our day is? So it causes us to say, well, we need to get back to trusting the Lord. We need to focus on Him and make sure we are aligning ourselves with Him and His expectations. The Lord will produce changes in Egypt's responses. It's indicating here a representative group, five cities that would be speaking the language of Canaan, assuming it's referencing Hebrew here, and that there would be a commitment to Yahweh that's coming. Well, this hasn't happened to our knowledge to this day, which again suggests it's looking toward a time future. There's also reference here to one city that would be indicated as a city of destruction, according to the New King James here, but there is a textual variant. It may be, and it's just a teeny tiny part of a letter difference as to whether it's city of destruction or city of the sun, and if it's city of the sun, it's talking about the city of On, or the Greek is Heliopolis, that city may be in view and is recognizing a particular place. And so that is a possibility. On was the center of the worship of God, and it may be indicating a sort of an end to the idolatry that's going on there because the Lord is going to be recognized as the one that they are looking to and swearing by. So again, this is an indication of the influence of the Lord and the impact that would be he would have in the future when Judah instead of being the one at the bottom of the pile, becomes at a place where Judah's looked up to. And then chapter 19, verses 19 and 20 and 21 and 22. In that day there will be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar to the Lord at its border. And it will be for a sign and for a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt. For they will cry to the Lord because of the oppressors, and he will send them a Savior and a mighty one, and he will deliver them. Well, that's a real turn of the tables from how Egypt has been, and that they will cry to the Lord when they're under oppression, assuming we're talking about a time that we would identify with the tribulation period. Verses 21 to 22, then the Lord will be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will be known, will know the Lord in that day. Again, the reference in that day. And will make sacrifice and offering. Yes, they will make a vow to the Lord and perform it. And the Lord will strike Egypt. He will strike and heal it. They will return to the Lord, and he will be entreated by them and heal them. Well, that's a real change in disposition that only the Lord can bring to pass. So we note here, in a future time, the Lord will be the object of worship in Egypt. Now, that's not something that immediately comes to mind when you think about Egypt, though we know that Egypt was the place where the nation Israel was essentially formulated, giving it an incubator at that time. The Lord will come to their aid as they seek him. There's reference to altar and a pillar here. The altar may be associated with Abraham and Joshua, who had built an altar to express gratitude at previous times. Jacob had erected a pillar when he memorialized God's covenant to him. And apparently the Egyptians will do these things in their land in this future day. There's a notation that Josephus had made with regard to a time in the intertestamental period where an altar had been made to Yahweh by a Jewish person, but that doesn't seem to fit what's noted here. But he does bring it up and suggests it as a possible response to what Isaiah had to say here. Also, the Lord will bring discipline and healing as needed. And the Lord will bring discipline because he wants to see these people come into line, which suggests that he's not just going to wipe them all off the face of the earth. He's actually going to work with them and seek to draw them to himself at some time in the future. And so that's a more hopeful element that's communicated here, and the purpose of the discipline would be for bringing them to the place of ultimate healing, and that healing would be something that would be coming in the past. And so even though it's hard for us to imagine Egypt coming around and actually seeking the Lord, this is an indication that that is anticipated. Then verses 23 to 25. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and Assyria will come into Egypt, and Egypt into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians. Now, there's a twist. These two groups that were basically fighting each other, and of course, Israel, Judah were in the middle, in terms of where they were located. Verse 24, in that day, Israel will be one of three with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. How in the world can you put those three in the same sentence in a positive way? And here we have it. In a future time, some nations will have positive relationships that we otherwise would not have associated as having them. And so these people will have transformed relationships. That's going to require something of a more significant nature. And if we would associate this, as seems to be the case, with the time of the tribulation, then leading into the millennial kingdom, we can see that there would be some impetus for this kind of thing to take place, where Egypt and Assyria, who were generally at significant odds with Judah in the middle, and now they're going to be working together and having a more positive disposition with one another. These people will be blessed by the Lord himself. And so this is, again, thinking of a future day, a time that's coming, associated probably with the millennial kingdom that is anticipated. Now, when you read a passage like this, you wonder, why is it that the Jews, the Jewish people, when they read Isaiah, they didn't come away and say, I guess God does love the Gentiles. How'd they miss that part? God did have a heart of concern for these people. I mean, you read the book of Jonah and several other places, you see it as well. So then the transition then to the next chapter, what we see here is in chapter 20, there's an incident that illustrates the world powers of Isaiah's day, that they were indeed subject to Yahweh, just as the prophet had proclaimed at various times in the past, and particularly in these last several verses. And there is a third sign in the book as well. And so we come to a rather interesting section of Scripture, the unusual illustration of a coming judgment. Verses 1 and 2 of chapter 20. In the year that Tartan came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and took it, at the same time the Lord spoke to Isaiah the son of Amoz, saying, "Go and remove the sackcloth from your body and take your sandals off your feet." So he did, walking naked and barefoot. Now, what on earth is this all about? Not something you expect to read in Scripture. Really? This is what's going on? So we need to think about, what is this all about? The historical setting with a graphic illustration. Well, the year that's in view here was 711 BC. And chapter 20, verse 1 introduces the historical setting of the events that follow, much like chapter 7, verse 1 did for that section as well. But what we see is, for 4 years, Egypt had encouraged the city-states of western Palestine, that would be the Philistine cities, including Ashdod. He encouraged them, Egypt encouraged them to resist the Assyrian aggression with a promise of assistance. So here you have the area of what we would refer to as the Holy Land, also has been referred to as Palestine, right in the middle here, and you have Assyria to the north, and you have Egypt to the south, and this ends up being often the battleground between them. And so you have Ashdod right here, Ashkelon, and Gaza right in here, Jerusalem right across the way there. So Ashdod was the northernmost Philistine town, and it was about 35 miles west of Jerusalem. But in 713, Ashdod had rebelled against Assyria, and then Assyria came along and replaced her king with another one. I'm not going to give you the names because you won't want to remember them anyway. Rebellion continued, and so Ashdod sent out requests for help from Judah and Moab and Edom, and then Sargon II, 722-705, responded to Ashdod's rebellion by sending his second-in-command, which would be this Tartan, who reduced Ashdod to an Assyrian province. So Egypt's promised help never materialized. As a matter of fact, the Egyptians handed over the king to the Assyrians to avoid an Assyrian attack. So they were just looking out for themselves. So all of this is to say this is the time frame and what was going on historically. And it was at this time that Isaiah was called on to graphically illustrate the fate of those of Egypt and Cush. And we have noted that when it says in the New King James, Ethiopia, you should read Cush because that's what's actually there. And we just, again, it said, think of the people group, not current day Ethiopia, because you may not be quite as accurate. So when we think about prophets who have been asked to dramatize various things, we may think of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. This seems to be the first time, the only time that Isaiah was asked to do something of this nature. And if you had to be asked to do something, this probably would be one you would want to decline. But that's what he was asked to do, to take off his clothes and his shoes, his sandals. But we want to make one observation here. It's been pointed out as people have looked at this text as to what the word naked here means. Is it totally naked, or is it clothed only in a loincloth? And it, the way the word is used in different places, it could be either. And there are some texts noted. So we can kind of suspend judgment and say we're not really sure what he had in mind, but the Jewish mindset and concern over proper propriety would suggest it was probably he was still probably wearing a loincloth, just if that gives you a little more comfort with what's going on here. So no matter what, it would have been a startling situation. And to suggest that this goes on for 3 years, that seemed like a long time to make a point. But that's what was indicated here. Then verses 3 and 4. Then the Lord said, just as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and a wonder against Egypt and Ethiopia or Cush, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians as prisoners and the Ethiopians or the Cushites as captives, young and old, naked and barefoot. And then we have this included statement with their buttocks uncovered to the shame of Egypt, which would suggest that perhaps this was a condition that was even greater than what the condition that Isaiah had experienced, though you could read it a couple of different ways. So, the anticipated results of the fulfilled illustration. This was a sign of Assyria's capture and plundering of Egypt. It was a warning of divine judgment against Egypt and Cush. And it should have been an indicator to Judah not to trust in Egypt because they are going to get theirs. It's going to come back on them. And as nations are wont to do, they look to somebody who they think can give them what they want. In this case, they thought Judah was thinking, well, this is a pretty powerful nation. We'll trust in them when the Assyrian option didn't do well, and it wasn't going to do well for Egypt either. This was an indication of ultimate domination by the enemy. And therefore, the state of the captives that's indicated here would be that of humiliation and shame, which was a common thing in the ancient world, to mistreat people and to show your domination and to provide as much discomfort and show of your exercise of control over them as possible. Then the last couple of verses here, verses 5 and 6 of chapter 20. Then they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and Egypt, their glory. And the inhabitant of this territory will say in that day, surely such is our expectation. Whenever we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria, how shall we escape? It's a realization that it's not a real positive picture. The practical outcome from the illustrated lesson. Judah was to learn a lesson about trusting in the wrong things, a lesson we need as well. Isaiah had predicted the dismay of the pro-Egyptian faction in Judah when Assyria carried the Egyptians and Cushites off as captives in 701 B.C. And so that's the picture that's indicated here. So, again, Judah, Isaiah is saying, don't trust in either of these nations because I am overriding them. They are going to be trembling at what God is going to do. They are not somebody that you should trust when you are trembling about those who look like they're going to cause you trouble. Trust in the Lord. And then humanly devised solutions to spiritual problems will ultimately fail. And that was the lesson that Isaiah was wanting to communicate to probably all people, but to Judah in particular, since that was his more immediate emphasis in saying, you know, when you trust in other nations for help or when you trust in other things, that's a spiritual problem. It's not just a physical problem. And if you get the spiritual problem properly addressed, then God can work out other things in other ways. But you need to trust in Him. And that's the lesson that we need to come away with as well. Recognize that so many of the things that are being dealt with today are spiritual problems. And that's the matter that we need to recognize. And so we need to trust in Him. And part of the reason we trust in Him is because He has provided for our ultimate spiritual need, and that is salvation through Christ.